God is a cruel tyrant. Augustine assumes that original sin is passed along in the very fluids of procreation, and that sexual intercourse, because it involves a loss of rational control, is always at least venially sinful, and should be indulged in as little as possible. Remember how important control, the opposite of chaos, was to the ancients. Augustine's is an argument that could have been made by a Stoic or Buddhist as well as a Christian. Julian informs Augustine that he has sex with his wife whenever and wherever he feels like it. Augustine explodes.
Really? Really? Is that your experience? So you would not have married couples restrain that evil? I refer, of course, to your favourite good. So you would have them jump into bed whenever they like, whenever they feel tickled by desire. Far be it from them to postpone this itch till bedtime. Let's have your legitimate union of bodies whenever your natural good is excited. If this is the sort of married life you lead, don't drag up your experience in debate.
Here is Augustine, at his Ciceronian worst, arguing without regard to fairness or truth, arguing to win by the most scurrilous kind of argument, the ad hominem. We should not forget that the ancient world, both Western and Eastern, often found sexual passion, especially in women, an object of mockery and even of contempt. Augustine goes further, and by the end of his life, the reformed profligate deems a woman's embraces sordid, filthy, and horrible. Julian is proposing a new approach based on his own experience, but he is a rational man who will not receive his justification till the thought of Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. Augustine, the feeling man, here shows the limits of feeling when mind has shut down to all that opposes its already established propositions. Augustine lived before the time of crucifixes, confessionals, and statues of the Virgin Mary, but one can imagine that he would have approved of them all. The bloody corpus is Augustine himself, splayed like Christ between heaven and earth. The shadows of the confessional would have given him the perfect outlet for his exquisite sympathy towards sinners. Against Pelagius's prissy claim that a man is responsible for his every action, Augustine had insisted that many sins are committed by men weeping and groaning in their distress. Mary, mother of celibate clerics who have turned their back on human love, would have presented Augustine with the perfect heavenly projection of his own domineering mother. Augustine, for all his greatness, has become in old age the type of the evil cleric, full of mercy for those who fear him, full of seething contempt for those who dare oppose him, scheming to make common cause with Babylon and whatever state-sponsored cruelty will, in the name of order, suppress his opposition. There is not a country in the world today that does not still possess a few examples of the type. Meanwhile, on an island off the Atlantic coast that had never heard of Augustine or his battles. Chapter 3. A Shifting World of Darkness. unholy island. There is a plain in northwest Ireland called Rathcrohan, the medieval word Rath indicating that a notable and fortified dwelling once stood there. In the centuries of Ireland's prehistory, before the written word, this place was called Cruachan E, and here stood the royal palace from which the province of Connaught was ruled. It was a primitive building, built by local craftsmen from local materials, and yet it was a place that might please our contemporary eye. Round, light, two-storied, and held aloft by carved wooden pillars that created a small maze of well-constructed rooms, panelled in red yew, and at its centre the royal hall and bedroom, guarded by screens of copper with bars of silver and gold birds on the screens, and precious jewels in the birds' heads for eyes. As such a palace was anciently described. Incredibly enough, we have a sort of record of a conversation that once took place in this bedroom. It is as if we can listen in on an exchange that is roughly 2 millennia old. The royal bed is laid, and 2 large figures are reclining there, conversing playfully amid the pillows, as might any man and woman when day is done. Arlil, the king, is musing.
"It is true what they say, love. It is well for the wife of a wealthy man."
"True enough," replies Maeve, the queen. "What put that in your mind?"
"It struck me how much better off you are today than the day I married you."
"I was well enough off without you."
"Then your wealth was something I didn't know or hear much about, except for your woman's things and the neighbouring enemies making off with loot and plunder."
Maeve doesn't care for the direction the conversation is taking, and reminding Arlil that her father was High King of Ireland, Yochi Fedlach, the Steadfast. She gives him a quick tour of her genealogy, in case he'd forgotten. Of Yochi's 6 daughters, Maeve was highest and haughtiest. "I outdid them in grace and giving and battle and warlike combat. I had 1,500 soldiers in my royal pay, all exiled sons, and the same number of free-born native men. And for every paid soldier, I had 10 more men, and 9 more, and 8, and 7, and 6, and 5, and 4, and 3, and 2, and 1. And that was only our ordinary household." Clearly stung, she barrels on, letting Arlil know who led whom into this bed. "My father gave me a whole province of Ireland. This province ruled from Cruachan, which is why I am called Maeve of Cruachan." Maeve recounts her wooing by the kings of Ireland. "And I wouldn't go, for I asked a harder wedding gift than any woman ever asked before from a man in Ireland. The absence of meanness and jealousy and fear." She had decided Arlil had these qualities and settled on him. "When we were promised, I brought you the best wedding gift a bride can bring. Apparel enough for 12 men, a chariot worth 7 bondmaids, the width of your face of red gold, and the weight of your left arm of light gold. so if anyone causes you shame or upset or trouble, the right to compensation is mine, for you're a kept man." Alil responds hotly that he has two kings for brothers, and that he let them rule because they were older, not because they are better than I am in grace and giving. I never heard in all Ireland of a province run by a woman except this one, which is why I came and took the kingship here. It still remains, says Maeve between her teeth, that my fortune is greater than yours. You amaze me. No one has more, shouts Alil, gesturing grandly, than I have, and I know it. All right, then, they must take inventory. That very night, the lowliest of their possessions were brought out to see who had more property and jewels and precious things. Their buckets and tubs and iron pots, jugs and washpails and vessels with handles. Then their finger rings, bracelets, thumb rings and gold treasures were brought out, and their cloths of purple, blue, black, green and yellow, plain grey and many-coloured, yellow-brown, checked and striped. Their herds of sheep were taken in off the fields and meadows and plains. They were measured and matched, and found to be the same in numbers and size. Even the great ram leading Maeve's sheep, the worth of one bond made by itself, had a ram to match him leading Alil's sheep. From pasture and paddock, their teams and herds of horses were brought in, for the finest stallion in Maeve's stud, worth one bond made by himself, Alil had a stallion to match. Their vast herds of pigs were taken in from the woods and gullies and waste places. They were measured and matched and noted, and Maeve had one fine boar, but Alil had another. Then their droves and free-wandering herds of cattle were brought in from the woods and wastes of the province. These were matched and measured and noted also, and found to be the same in number and size. But there was one great bull in Arlil's herd that had been a calf of one of Maeve's cows. Finvinach was his name, the white-horned. And Finvinach, refusing to be led by a woman, had gone over to the king's herd. Maeve couldn't find in her herd the equal of this bull, and her spirits dropped as though she hadn't a single penny. How do we come by this extraordinary encounter? Can we depend at all on its accuracy? I have been quoting from the first scene of the Irish prose epic Táin Bó Cúaillí, The Cattle Raid of Cúaillí. There are several versions, none of them complete, the earliest dating to the 8th century. This scene comes to us from a 12th century manuscript, translated masterfully from the ancient Irish by the contemporary Irish poet Thomas Kinsella. The manuscript tradition, however, is based on an earlier oral tradition that may go back to the time of Christ. And though we can hardly claim to have this royal conversation word for word, the oral scribal tradition witnesses that such a conversation may well have been the impetus for the rest of the epic action of the Táin. Maeve calls for the chief messenger, Macruadh, and asks where the match of Alil's bull might be found. "I know where to find such a bull, and better," Macruadh tells her.
In the province of Ulster, in the territory of Cooley, in Doira MacFiachna's house. Don Cooley is the bull's name, the brown bull of Cooley. Go there, MacRoth, orders Maeve. Ask Doira to lend me Don Cooley for a year, and at the end of the year he can have 50 yearling heifers in payment for the loan, and the brown bull of Cooley back. And you can offer him this too, MacRoth, if the people of the country think badly of losing their fine jewel, the Don Cooley. If Doira himself comes with the bull, I'll give him a portion of the fine plain of E, equal to his own lands, and a chariot worth thrice 7 bondmaids, and my own friendly ties on top of that. The reader is not surprised when Doira graciously accepts this deal. Unfortunately, Doira's generous hospitality to MacRoth's party undoes the agreement, for they were given the best of good food and kept supplied with the festive fare until they grew drunk and noisy. The messengers then get into a verbal duel about whether Maeve's forces could have taken the brown bull from Ulster by force, had Doira not agreed to the transaction. Doira's steward enters the room just as one boasts. We would have taken it anyway, with or without his leave. With that, the deal is off. And only it isn't my habit, smoulders Doira, after he has learned of the drunken boast, to murder messengers or travellers or any other wayfarers. Not one of you would leave here alive. When MacRoth recounts this outcome to Maeve, she announces genially, We needn't polish the knobs and knots in this, MacRoth. It was well known it would be taken by force if it wasn't given freely, and taken it will be. Maeve assembles a vast army, which, under her command, sets out forthwith for Cooley to capture the brown bull. En route, they will be met not by the forces of Ulster, who have been laid low by mysterious pangs, but by one champion only, the boy Cuchulainn. The first thing that will probably strike any modern reader who opens the tome is what a rough, strange world this is, both simple and full of barbaric splendour. Here is no deliberation or subtlety, no refinement or ambiguity. We know immediately that we are at a far remove from Virgil, Cicero, Plato, and the whole literary tradition of the classical world, excepting perhaps Homer. The characters of the tome do not think profoundly. They do not seem to think at all. But they do act, and with a characteristic panache and roundness that easily convinces us of their humanity. And none more rounded than Maeve. How different a queen she is from Dido. One cannot see Maeve languishing for a lover, or for anything. If Augustine was the first self-conscious man, Maeve, at the other end of the consciousness spectrum, is pre-reflective. Her ready speech, moreover, is characteristically Irish. We can imagine her sharp first sentence, What put that in your mind? On the lips of many a character in modern Irish drama. And this opens up to us an astonishing continuity, from prehistoric Ireland to the present day.
the sexual frankness of these characters is unlike anything in classical literature, even in the folk epics of Homer. We would need to reach all the way back to the Sumerian epic of Gilgamesh to find anything comparable. Maeve's offer of her own friendly thighs to seal the bargain with Doira is obviously thrown in casually. And it is just as obvious that Maeve is not in the remotest sense a needy woman. The very phrase would curdle before her. Rather, in early Irish literature, both men and women openly admire one another's physical endowments and invite one another to bed without formality. In another story, Deirdre of the Sorrows, passes Noishue on the rampart of Evanmacha, the chief seat of the Ulster kings. They have never seen each other before. Of Deirdre, the king's druid, Cuthbert, had prophesied that high queens will ache with envy to see those lips of Parthian red opening on her pearly teeth and see her pure, perfect body. Though Noishue knows that she is pledged to the old king and that there is a curse on her, he cannot help himself. That is a fine heifer going by. As well it might, Deirdre shoots back. The heifers grow big where there are no bulls. You have the bull of this province all to yourself, the king of Ulster. Of the two, I'd pick a game young bull like you. Guess what happens next? Similarly, there is recorded in another story of the Toyne cycle this conversation between the boy Cuchulainn, the Irish Achilles, and Ymir, the girl he comes to woo. May your road be blessed, cries Ymir on his approach. May the apple of your eye see only good, returns Cuchulainn. Then, peering down her dress, I see a sweet country. I could rest my weapon there. The tasks the hero must perform before this sweet country is open to him are laid out by Ymir herself, not by her father, as would be the case in a continental fairy tale. No man will travel this country until he has killed 100 men at every ford from Schenven Ford on the river Alvina to Banchwing, where the frothy Bra makes Fedel bleep. In that sweet country I'll rest my weapon. No man will travel this country until he has done the feat of the salmon leap, carrying twice his weight in gold, and struck down 3 groups of 9 men with a single stroke, leaving the middleman of each 9 unharmed. In that sweet country I'll rest my weapon. No man will travel this country who hasn't gone sleepless from Samhain, Halloween, when summer goes to its rest, until Imbolc, Candlemas, or Groundhog Day, when the ewes are milked at spring's beginning, from Imbolc to Beltane, May Day, at the summer's beginning, and from Beltane to Brown Troachan, Earth's sorrowing autumn. It is said and done. Well, they may not be civilized, but they certainly are confident. And this confidence is one of the open-handed pleasures of early Irish literature. We have no trouble imagining these people, both men and women, riding hard on horseback, drawing the blood of their enemies, leaping about in muscular dancing, and passing the damp Irish nights in vigorous coupling. Even their sorrows and deaths are tossed off with a shrug, though they understand tragedy and receive it as convulsively as any people. "For the great gales of Ireland," wrote G.K. Chesterton, "are the men that God made mad, for all their wars are merry, and all their songs are sad." The Irish are part of a larger ethnic grouping called the Celts, preferably pronounced with a hard C, who first entered Western consciousness about 600 B.C., only a century and a half after the legendary founding of the city of Rome, when, like the German barbarians long after them, they crossed the Rhine. One branch of the Celtic tree settled in present-day France and became the Gauls, whom Julius Caesar would conquer in the century before Christ, and who, in their Romanized phase, would produce the effete Ausonius. A cognate tribe settled the Iberian Peninsula and became great sea traders. Indeed, traces of the buildings of these Iberian Celts may have been found as far afield as New Hampshire, which would make the Celts the first Europeans to reach the Americas. In the 3rd century BC, Celts invaded the Greek world, advancing as far south as Delphi and settling in present-day Turkey, where, as the Galatians... Note the similarity of consonantal sounds in Celt, Gaul, and Galatian. They were recipients of one of Paul's letters. Siblings of the Gaulish Celts crossed to Britain as early as 400 BC, becoming the Britons, who 9 centuries later, in the time of Augustine and Patricius, would be gradually pushed by the Angles and Saxons into Cornwall, where they would become the Cornish, and into Wales, where they would become the Welsh. It is from these British Celts that the legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table would spring. Echoes of the language they spoke may be heard today in the form of modern Welsh and Breton, which belong to the same linguistic group as Gaulish. About 350 BC, some 50 years after Celtic tribes began their invasion of Britain, they reached Ireland. Some, no doubt, came by way of Britain, but it is most likely that those who gained ascendancy were Iberian Celts, whose language was somewhat different from that of the British invaders. These became, in time, the Irish. And the language they spoke belongs not to the Brythonic branch of Welsh and Breton, but to a Celtic branch called Goidelic, by scholars, whose present-day shoots are the last living Gaelic tongues, Irish and Scots Gaelic. Ireland itself is the only Celtic nation-state in our world. All the other Celts have been absorbed by larger political entities. In the Irish foundation myth, the sons of Bíl, survivors of the Great Flood, through their descent from Noah, reach Ireland from Spain and wrest it from a tribe called Tuatha De Danann, the people of the goddess Danu. The connection to Noah can only be the result of later monkish tinkering with the original material. Somehow, the Irish had to be connected to things biblical. But there is little reason to doubt the Iberian connection. We have evidence that the Tuatha De Danann have some historical reality as well. We know that Ireland was peopled before the arrival of the Celts in the 4th century BC, and that an earlier people had built the great barrows and magnificently carved tumuli that dot the Irish landscape to this day. In the foundation myth, the Tuatha De Danann are preternaturally skilled in building and craftsmanship. These taller, otherworldly beings eventually devolve into the little people, the fairies and leprechauns of later Irish legend, whose spirits haunt the tombs and fairy mounds they once built. The little people is a euphemism, rather like the prehistoric phrase le bon Dieu, meant to disguise the speaker's fear of something unfamiliar and much larger than himself. It is possible that this flickering phenomenon of the little people represents the afterglow of Irish guilt over their exploitation of more artful Aborigines. Even at this early stage of their development, the Irish were intoxicated by the power of words. Every noble Irish family maintained a family of ancestral poets. The sons of Beal were accompanied by their poet, Overhin, who, stepping off the boat that brought him to the Irish shore, proclaimed, "I am an estuary into the sea. I am a wave of the ocean. I am the sound of the sea. I am a powerful ox. I am a hawk on a cliff. I am a dewdrop in the sun. I am a plant of beauty. I am a boar for valor. I am a salmon in a pool. I am a lake in a plain. I am the strength of art." One problem with this Irish prehistoric material is that we cannot date it with any precision. From the Celtic invasion in the 4th century BC to the invasion of books 9 centuries later, after which the traditional oral lore began to be written down, we are looking at a timeless Ireland. We can presume that Overhin's poem, at least in its current form, is not actually as old as the Celtic invasion, but we cannot be sure how old it is. We can date the action of the Toyne, perhaps to the 1st century of our era, perhaps to a century or so later. But there is no way of knowing when this episode or that was added to the strand of narrative. What hints we have suggest that Ireland was, during this entire period, a land outside of time. That, in fact, it changed little from the time of Overhin to the time of Augustine. This was an illiterate, aristocratic, semi-nomadic, Iron Age warrior culture. Its wealth based on animal husbandry and slavery. The importance of both of which one cannot fail to notice in the Toyne's royal inventory. Such cultures have been known to exist for many hundreds of years without undergoing appreciable alteration. What normally changes them is outside influence, rather than inner dynamics. And Ireland, splendidly isolated in the Atlantic and largely beyond the traffic of civilization, suffered few intrusive influences. We can safely assume, therefore, that the world of Maeve and Alil was little different from the earlier Ireland that the Celtic invaders had made, and that this world, in most respects, remained intact into the century of Rome's fall. On this timeless island, one would have come in contact with a culture very like that of the British and continental Celts, prior to their centuries of Roman influence. In this place and period, one might also have experienced a milieu something like such pre-Roman cultures as Homeric Greece, the India of the Mahabharata and Sumer, with their common equipage of war horses and warrior chariots, and their common standards of heroic action. The Irish, like all the Celts, stripped before battle and rushed their enemy naked, carrying sword and shield, but wearing only sandals and torque, a twisted golden neck ornament. Just such a torque may be seen around the neck of the naked dying Gaul, a Greek statue of the 3rd century BC. The Gaul's tough hide has been pierced by a heart wound between his ribs, and he is bleeding to death. Sitting on the ground, he holds himself erect with a last effort of will. His face is a drama of both dignity and hopelessness, as he casts a cold eye on life, on death. The Romans, in their first encounters with these exposed, insane warriors, were shocked and frightened. Not only were the men naked, they were howling and, it seemed, possessed by demons. So outrageous were their strength and verve. Urged on by the infernal skirl of pipers, they presented to the unaccustomed and throbbing Roman sensorium a multimedia event featuring all the terrors of hell itself. The Irish heroes were aware that they became possessed when confronted by the enemy, and that their appearance could alter considerably, and they called this phenomenon the warp spasm. When, in the Toyne, the armies of Connaught are confronted by Ulster's champion, the 17-year-old Cuchulain, this is how he appears. The first warp spasm seized Cuchulain and made him into a monstrous thing, hideous and shapeless, unheard of. His shanks and his joints, every knuckle and angle and organ from head to foot, shook like a tree in the flood or a reed in the stream. His body made a furious twist inside his skin, so that his feet and chins and knees switched to the rear and his heels and calves switched to the front. The bald sinews of his calves switched to the front of his shins, each big knot the size of a warrior's bunched fist. On his head, the temple sinews stretched to the nape of his neck, each mighty, immense, measureless knob as big as the head of a month-old child. His face and features became a red bowl. He sucked one eye so deep into his head that a wild crane couldn't probe it onto his cheek out of the depths of his skull. The other eye fell out along his cheek, his mouth weirdly distorted, his cheek peeled back from his jaws until the gullet appeared. His lungs and liver flapped in his mouth and throat. His lower jaw struck the upper a lion-killing blow, and fiery flakes, large as a ram's fleece, reached his mouth from his throat. His heart boomed loud in his breast, like the baying of a watchdog at its feed, or the sound of a lion among bears. Malignant mists and spurts of fire, the torches of Bave, flickered red in the vaporous clouds that rose boiling above his head, so fierce was his fury. The hair of his head twisted like the tangle of a red thorn bush stuck in a gap. If a royal apple tree with all its kingly fruit were shaken above him, scarce an apple would reach the ground, but each would be spiked on a bristle of his hair as it stood up on his scalp with rage. The hero halo rose out of his brow, long and broad as a warrior's whetstone, long as a snout, and he went mad, rattling his shields, urging on his charioteer, and harassing the hosts. Then, tall and thick, steady and strong, high as the mast of a noble ship, rose up from the dead centre of his skull a straight spout of black blood, darkly and magically smoking like the smoke from a royal hostel when a king is coming to be cared for at the close of a winter day. In a word, a formidable opponent. Blithe exaggeration is a regular feature of Irish heroic literature, a convention as enjoyable to its intended audience as the exaggerations of a sportscaster to a Super Bowl audience. As in so many passages from the Toyne, this one yields up a vivid miniature of the period in the near Homeric simile describing a warm and welcoming hostel on a winter's evening. More than this, we glimpse something of the emotional temper of these people and the high pitch of feeling at which their lives were lived. I do not question for a second that the warp spasm was a real experience, keenly felt by its subject and plainly observable to the opposing army. Anyone who has ever felt, or been the object of, real rage can understand the distortions described in this passage, as I think can anyone who has experienced terror. What a perfect ritual for dealing with the warrior's own terror, as the booming of the heart within his breast is transformed into the baying of a watchdog at its feed. And he himself is transformed from ordinary mortal into killing machine. Cuchulainn then went into the middle of them and beyond, and mowed down great ramparts of his enemies' corpses, circling completely around the armies three times, attacking them in hatred. They fell soul to soul and neck to headless neck, so dense was that destruction. He circled them three times more in the same way, and left a bed of them six deep in a great circuit, the souls of three to the necks of three in a circle round the camp. Any count or estimate of the rabble who fell there is unknown and unknowable. Only the names of the chiefs have been counted. In this great carnage on Methevna Plain, Cuchulainn slew 130 kings, as well as an uncountable horde of dogs and horses, women and boys and children, and rabble of all kinds. Not one man in three escaped without his thigh-bone or his head or his eye being smashed, or without some blemish for the rest of his life. And when the battle was over, Cuchulainn left without a scratch or a stain on himself, his helper, or either of his horses. More often than not, Cuchulainn reminds us of a comic book hero. The only audience likely to be amazed by exploits like these today would be pre-adolescent boys. But then, in early stories like the Toyne, we touch the imaginative childhood of the human race. Even the hero's gear suggests such a connection. Here, for instance, is the description of Cuchulainn's chariot. When the spasm had run through the high hero Cuchulainn, he stepped into his sickle war chariot that bristled with points of iron and narrow blades, with hooks and hard prongs and heroic frontal spikes, with ripping instruments and tearing nails on its shafts and straps and loops and cords. The body of the chariot was spare and slight and erect, fitted for the feats of a champion, with space for the lordly warrior's eight weapons. Speedy as the wind, or as a swallow, or a deer darting over the level plain. The chariot was settled down on two fast steeds, wild and wicked, neat-headed and narrow-bodied, with slender quarters and rowan breast, firm in hoof and harness, a notable sight in the trim chariot shafts. One horse was lithe and swift-leaping, high-arched and powerful, long-bodied and with great hooves. The other, flowing-maned and shining, slight and slender in hoof and heel. In that style, then, he drove out to find his enemies. How these people would have loved the Batmobile! But while they are hypnotized by physical display, calculation is beyond them. The numbers of the dead, as of the living, are considerably inflated. Nothing like a real accounting is attempted. These counts are not dissimilar to the ages of the centuries-old patriarchs found in the book of Genesis. All the storyteller really wants to say is that the number of dead was astonishingly large, or that Methuselah lived a very long time. Throughout the early centuries of our era, human settlements were far smaller than they are today. The population of a great city or a small country could be counted in the thousands, and between the settled places lay unpeopled wildernesses, owned by no one in particular, which offered perils to conventional travellers, but sanctuaries for the dispossessed. When Maeve and Arlil call for their pigs and cattle, these are brought in from the woods and wastes, the no-man's lands, the places in between. No character in the Toyne is drawn as perceptively as Maeve. She is so full of life and colour that even Cuchulainn seems pale beside her. When Fingon the healer comes to the sorely wounded Cethern, he points to Cethern's largest wound. A vain, arrogant woman gave you that wound. I believe you are right, replies Cethern. A tall, fair, long-faced woman with soft features came at me. She had a head of yellow hair and two gold birds on her shoulders. She wore a purple cloak folded about her, with five hands' breadth of gold on her back. She carried a light, stinging, sharp-edged lance in her hand, and she held an iron sword with a woman's grip over her head. A massive figure. The massive figure of Maeve dominates the Toyne, as does no other woman in any epic we have left to us. In the Iliad, Helen makes her cameo appearance. In the Aeneid, Dido has an interesting supporting role. But the only women in classical literature who impel the story forward are to be found in Greek drama. Clytemnestra, Antigone, Medea. There are ways in which the Toyne seems closer to drama than to Homeric epic. It is full of dialogue and short on poetry, which appears only occasionally, and for the most part in archaic incantations, not unlike the choruses of Greek plays. The Greek drama of the 5th century BC grew out of the seasonal liturgies of an agricultural people, and magnified the conflicts of their social life, thus the necessity of significant female characters. But one cannot imagine a woman in Greece's heroic age, that is, 3 or 4 centuries before the dramatists, in the period of Greece's early development, most comparable to that of the Toyne, standing on the Trojan battlefield, or travelling with Odysseus, just as unthinkable would be a woman travelling with Aeneas. At the end of the toine, its ostensible moral is uttered by the vaguely omniscient Fergus. We followed the rump of a misguiding woman. It is the usual thing for a herd led by a mare to be strayed and destroyed. Maeve does not reappear after this judgment on her, but even this last word seems ontologically overshadowed by her personality. Nor is she an exception in this literature. Cuchulainn is trained in battlecraft by three women, each more extraordinary than the one before. The god of war, mentioned briefly in the toine, is put in the shade by the three goddesses of war, who regularly make the scene and stir things up. One of these, Maeve, is mentioned in the description of Cuchulainn's warp spasm. Deirdre, pledged to Conor, the Ulster king, runs off with Noishu and his brothers, the sons of Uisle, only to be tracked down and recaptured, as Noishu is slain. Though she submits to Conor, Deirdre never smiles again. Conor, out of spite, decides to share her with Owen Mochdruthach, the king of Fernmach, who, to win favour with Conor, had killed Noishu. Not in a fair fight, but through trickery. They set out the next day for the fair of Macha. She was behind Owen in the chariot. She had sworn that two men alive in the world together would never have her. "This is good, Deirdre," Conor said. "Between me and Owen, you are a sheep eyeing two rams." A big block of stone was in front of her. She let her head be driven against the stone and made a mass of fragments of it. And she was dead. A suicide, all right, but nothing like Dido's. These are all women who, in life and death, exhibit the power of their will and the strength of their passion. Here is part of Deirdre's lament for Noishu, spoken to the royal musicians who had come to cheer her up. "Sweet in your sight the fiery stride of raiding men returned to Evan. More nobly strode the three proud sons of Uisle toward their home. Noishu bearing the best mead, I would wash him by the fire. Ordon with a stag or a boar, Onle shouldering his load, the son of Ness," that is, King Conor, "battle-proud, drinks, you say, the choicest mead. Choicer still, a brimming sea, I have taken frequently. Modest Noishu would prepare a cooking pit in the forest floor. Sweeter then than any meat, the son of Uisle's honey-sweet. Though for you the times are sweet with pipers and with trumpeters, I swear today I can't forget that I have known far sweeter airs. Noishu, his grave mound is made and mournfully accompanied, the highest hero, and I poured the deadly drink when he died. His crop gold fleece I loved, and fine form, a tall tree. Alas, I needn't watch today, nor wait for the son of Uisle. I loved the modest, mighty warrior, loved his fitting, firm desire, loved him at daybreak as he dressed by the margin of the forest. Those blue eyes that melted women and menaced enemies I loved. Then, with our forest journey done, his chanting.